From WBEZ Chicago and PRX, this is Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. This week, we'll share some of our favorite duets from pop music history. Two talented musicians working together to create something better than either on their own.
Some velvet morning when I'm straight.
Flowers growing on a hill.
I'm gonna open up your gate.
Plus, we'll interview the duo from the Broken Record podcast, author Malcolm Gladwell and journalist Bruce Hedlum.
That's all coming up on Sound Opinions.
You're listening to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot. He's Jim DeRogatis. And this week, we're talking about some of our favorite duets.
That's coming up a little bit later in the show. But first, my conversation with Malcolm Gladwell and Bruce Hedlum.
A few years ago, Malcolm Gladwell, a staff writer for The New Yorker, an author of best-selling books like The Tipping Point and Outliers, made waves in the publishing world by choosing to make a podcast instead of authoring his next book. And after three seasons of that show called Revisionist History, Gladwell has now teamed up with a friend and former New York Times editor, Bruce Hedlum, for a new show focused on music called Broken Record.
Why, my friend, would Wile E. Coyote, super genius, literary hero to our generation, want to do a music podcast? You know, I mean, Greg Kot and I do it, but that's only because we can't do anything else.
First of all, so not true. I'm sure you could do whatever you want. Why not? I love music. I was doing Revisionist History, and every season I would do a music show, and they were always my favorite shows.
Sure.
And so then I was chatting with Bruce and then with Rick, and we all decided that why not just do one devoted entirely to music?
And Rick is Rick Rubin, no slouch.
Rick is Rick Rubin, the third amigo. Yes, he was a crucial part of this operation.
Bruce, tell me, you and Malcolm were friends from Canada, right? I mean, going way back?
Way back. We have known each other since we were 6 years old. And
wow.
I'm not going to give you the year or even the decade.
It's a long time ago.
But it's a long time ago. Yeah, we met each other when we were 6 years old, and we have been friends ever since.
I've been visiting two musical super geeks, like Kot and I were, you know, sitting in the basement, listening to, you know, choose your favorite, Lamb Lies Down on Broadway or Black Sabbath or whatever, and coming up and bonding through music.
I do remember listening to Bridge Over Troubled Water in Malcolm's basement, and I remember it was a record he had borrowed from the library. But actually, our musical taste diverged, I would say, early and often.
They diverged, I think, around the age of seven. Bruce's brothers were really into Yes. And I would be dragged to Bruce's house, and he would play Yes albums for me. And I used to always think, this is the worst music I've ever heard. I cannot believe it. And then, not just Yes, but then the solo albums by each of the members of Yes.
Yeah, I think he had a particularly bad reaction to Oleus of Sun Hilo by John Anderson.
No, it was Patrick Moran's Fish Out of Water.
No. Chris Squire did Fish Out of Water.
Chris Squire.
Patrick Moran's, yeah, it was Patrick Moran's just did an album called I, or I think that's what the title was. It was very stylized handwriting.
You know, Chris Squire was the bass player, Malcolm. So Fish Out of Water, the bass, right? You know, bass, whatever.
Yes.
Witty, witty.
All that.
Yeah. You know, can I just say, and you guys will appreciate this and nobody else will, I drew the line at Ramshackled by Alan White.
Yeah. But he did play on Imagine by John Lennon.
I nothing against Alan White.
I can't believe, by the way, that I got lured into this thinking we were going to have a broad-ranging discussion of music, and what we're talking about is Yes. From the 90s. This is like bait and switch. You got me on, and now we're talking about...
Okay, but while we're here, I want to actually ask Malcolm a question that I don't know the answer to, and I know a lot about Malcolm, which is, I don't know when you started liking country music. It was long before I liked it. Is it when you moved to the States?
No. I started listening to it in high school, or middle school, rather, because my brother and I tuned into the local... Was it CKGL? No, what was it?
The local, CKCO.
CKCO, yeah. The local country music station. And I just love... I had been searching... Because I'm really only drawn... I'm not a musician, and I'm not really... I know less about music than almost anyone else. What I like is the storytelling. And I like the words, not... I don't know anything else. And finally, I found music that was about the words, you know, and about stories. I just thought that was... It was sort of... That was when I finally felt at home.
Well, I recall distinctly two episodes of revisionist history about country. One was based on your thesis that country is sadder than rock overall. Do you hold by that, Malcolm?
Sure. Yeah, I do. I mean, I wanted to... You're asking me... Those questions and theories are always posed in the general spirit of getting us to... have some fun, right?
Sure.
The great thing about talking about music is there are an endless number of rabbit holes. And what you really want to do when you listen to a podcast about music, I think, is go down lots of rabbit holes. The more, the better. And there just aren't as many opportunities for digression, I think, in other subject areas. I think music is like kind of the number one. It's even better than sports, I think, in terms of its opportunities for rabbit holes.
Yeah, well, that's why we started with Chris Squire's solo record.
Right? we're holding back because we've got a whole series on Chris Squire's solo work coming up.
That's right.
Oh, brilliant.
Well, also we're intimidated because we're speaking to critics and people who really know their music, and you know we're amateurs. So.
Oh, but that's nonsense. See, everyone is an expert. Everyone is a critic, right? I mean, all it takes is the passion and the desire to, or the follow through. You know, here is the context, the evidence, the insight that I base my opinion that Chris Squire's solo album sucks on.
Well, no, so here's my reading of that is slightly different, which is that the critic is someone who can tell you what they like and what they don't like and give you reasons.
Yeah, well, we're saying the same thing.
But the enthusiast, which is what I am, can only tell you what they like and give you a persuasive reason. So I don't have any faith whatsoever in my dislikes. I don't know enough to be able to tell you why I dislike or even trust in my judgment about something I dislike. All I can do is, in Broken Record, the ones I do are never about artists that I have a problem with because I don't feel comfortable with that.
Well, are you buying that, Bruce? I mean, you were an editor for a long time at the New York Times. You edited one of my heroes, in fact, media critic David Carr, who certainly never had a problem telling anybody what he disliked about anything, in addition to what he liked. Are you buying that, Malcolm? I think Malcolm is just passing the buck on this. I don't believe that he can't do negative criticism.
Music.
We decided very deliberately not to approach it as critics because honestly, neither of us feel we do have the critical chops. And look, I worked with terrific critics across the board, including David Carr, whom I edited for years at the New York Times, and you know Tony Scott and you know Tony Tomasini and John Perales. And I don't have what they have. I think what I have, and Malcolm has probably more than anybody I've ever met in my life, is a sense of story. And almost everything we're approaching, every subject we're approaching, every interview we're approaching is kind of looking for a story. I mean, several people have said to me, you know, well, why was the first interview Nile Rodgers?
Oh, and by the way, when I started playing it, I only imitated his just for a few bars. I started going...
It was simply because, by chance, I came across his autobiography, which is amazing. So then I'm I think I said something in the podcast. It's like a combination of James Baldwin and Charles Dickens. But that was the story with him. And, you know, there's a story with upcoming, we've got Roseanne Cash, and we just did Rufus Wainwright. And in every case, there's a mystery I want solved about what music means to them and how they communicate that to their audience. And it is that story we're looking for. And I think Malcolm and I don't talk in those terms, but I think that's what we're always looking for.
Well, kind of. I mean, you guys have the mission statement on the web for Broken Record. It's a show that tries to restart the conversation for a world without liner notes.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything's streaming, right? We can't sit there in front of the lava lamp and read the double truck gatefold sleeve liner notes anymore.
Yes. Now, I would say that's a blessing in some respects, if you have to sit there and actually read the story to The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway. And the lamb lies down.
It makes no sense. Yeah, you're lost to
begin
with.
It doesn't make any sense.
But, you know, if you go to Velvet Underground Live, 1969, the liner notes are phenomenal. And when I encountered them at 13, it blew my young mind. And it said that someday people will teach Lou Reed in literature classes the way we look at other great rock and rollers like Bach or Beethoven or Shakespeare. You know, and this is an idea Tony Scott, who you edited at the New York Times, he's been a guest on Sound Opinions, talks about in Better Living Through Criticism, right? This way that a critic, and I, you know, I'm not buying, you guys are critics, the way that a critic can illuminate and make connections and inspire you to dig deeper. Not that, you know, they're not trying to get you to love the music they love or hate the music they dislike. It's just a conversation between people who care passionately about the art.
I guess that's true. I do want people to have a different way into experience the music, because I do think it's, even with streaming and the variety of ways music comes to you, it doesn't come with a story anymore. But it's to try and put some of that context back for people.
Rick and I did an interview for Broken Record with Ezra Koenig of Vampire Weekend. Mm-hmm. And it was super interesting to me because we start talking, the conversation is sort of interesting but not really going anywhere for the first 10 minutes. And then he picks up his guitar right by his chair, and Rick asks him some question, and he says, oh, and he starts to answer, and then he realizes that he can answer the question better if he plays the thing he's talking about. And he picks up the guitar, puts it in his lap, and then the interview just takes off.
We don't want to have the entire song be 5-1-4. Bam, bam, bam.
Oh, can you give him the guitar so he can explain it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Just you have better access.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
So the part that I originally wrote on piano, you know, the chords are.
Because you realize suddenly it is the combination of he needs to play and talk simultaneously in order to be, to really communicate with us. And
sure.
It's, you get that kind of, there's a kind of richness to the conversation that occurs out of it. It's really, I just sort of sat there and the two of them just start talking, Rick and Ezra Koenig, and Ezra would, you know, play for 15 seconds and then talk for a minute, then play the thing he's talking about. And that, I just found that combination of playing and talking, which is something we try to do a lot of on Broken Record, almost to be the natural way to hear music. So the liner note was a version of that. It said, while you are listening to this album, you can read something that will enrich your experience of listening. But mm-hmm. we don't have that anymore. So what do we have? Well, one thing we can do is we can actually get the artist to break up their singing and playing with explanation in a way that's sort of natural and unforced. And that's to me, that's the kind of holy grail of this venture.
So with the entire universe of music now pretty much available to us at a keystroke, anything we can, there's no record we could name that is so obscure that you can't have it instantly on your iPhone, right? What's the role, do you guys both think, of the critic then in this new universe?
I think there is a kind of midwife role, which I think critics, you know, have always had. You know, Tony Scott being a good example of someone you just you trust to think this is interesting. You may not necessarily agree with them, but you'll take it seriously, and that you'll maybe rethink how you listen to music. I just did an episode with Roseanne Cash and her husband. I think I want people to hear what Roseanne Cash is doing because I think what she's doing is great. I want her to hear her sit and play in a room together only mm-hmm. with her husband, John Leventhal, because when they, you know, they've been together 23 years and when they play together, it's magic.
Mother and father, now that you're gone, it's not nearly long enough, still it seems too long.
And then I want them to rethink, well, wait, you know, how do you, what does it mean that artists keep going? You mentioned David Carr, because David and I had a running argument about this. For David, rock music was all about youth and energy. And once that was gone, he didn't want to hear from the people anymore. I think I mentioned like a Paul Westerberg album that I like. And he's like, no, no, no. He's in The Replacements or he doesn't exist. And he didn't want to know anything. For him, it's wrapped up in that youth and memory. Now, I will say, when The Replacements got back together, David was in the front row.
Yeah, of course.
But I always disagreed with that. I think artists have to be able to go on and do other things, and it's not always going to be wrapped up in that kind of youthful energy.
I thought of this. I was reading this weekend a book about Daryl Gates, the former chief of police for Los Angeles, mm-hmm. who was head of chief of police in Los Angeles from, or a leading member of, police department there from the 50s through the early 90s, right?
Through Rodney King.
But not just Rodney, from the Watts riots of 65 through the LA riots of 90, whatever it was, one or two. And I realized sort of halfway through, the book is really about the deteriorating relationship between the African-American community of Los Angeles and the kind of white power structure. And it's a 30-year story of this kind of one blow after another, one, and halfway through you realize, oh, this is where West Coast rap comes from. Because I'm a teenager with a little bit of gold and a pager, searching my car, looking for the product, thinking every nigga is selling narcotics. You rather see me in the pen than me and Lorenzo rolling in a Benzo. And if you don't know that story, Daryl Gates is the guy who invents SWAT teams, the militarization right. of modern police force starts in the LAPD in the 1970s. And all of a sudden, you know, police, you want to say, oh, that's where it comes from, right? It's not some song that was kind of like invented because it sounded cool. It arises out of something that was very particular. If you grew up in Los Angeles, if you were African-American growing up in Los Angeles in 1970 and you grew up on the You'll Love Story and of Watts on... What do you end up, and you saw the cops with their, you know, Gates was the guy who basically got these armed personnel carriers from the army and put a big battering ram on the back and would essentially mow down houses that he thought were crack houses throughout South sure. Central. You can't understand rap unless you know that history, and I didn't know that history until I read the book this weekend. Mm. And so my point is like that role, that when Bruce was talking about the midwife role, that's a hugely, all of a sudden... NWA matters to me. Whereas before, I didn't listen to them or know what was going on or think about it. I got something to say.
Selling narcotics. It has been an absolute pleasure talking to Malcolm Gladwell and Bruce Hedlum. Broken Record is their new podcast. Malcolm's done a million other things, including Revisionist History. Thank you, my friends.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was really fun.
Do you buy Malcolm Gladwell's distinction between critics and enthusiasts? Call and leave a message on our hotline, 888-859-1800. When we come back, we share some of our favorite duets. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. Yeah.
people on streets.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My duet partner is Greg Kot. And this week, we're sharing some of our all-time favorite duets. Throughout the history of popular music, there have been a lot of spectacular combinations across genres. Rock, pop, rap, soul, you name it. Two singers coming together, sometimes from different styles and completely different points of view, creating a special musical moment.
You're right, Jim. And for our choices that we're highlighting at length, we really wanted to choose songs that were less obvious. I'm going to kick us off.
Well, no, but before you get into it, what was your number one criteria for what a great duet is?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to have two voices on a song have a duet,
start
right?
There, yeah.
And there's got to be some kind of an exchange there.
A conversation, not unlike this one.
Indeed. And we have Simon and Garfunkel as maybe the classic vocal duo of the 60s, right? I mean, everybody thinks of Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel as the ones who defined that particular sound for the 60s generation. The track I'm going to play, though, sort of goes a little bit beyond that, a step beyond. When you think about vocal duets and you think about Simon and Garfunkel, they were modeling themselves after, say, those classic 50s singers like the Everly Brothers, Phil and Don. They established that sound, two voices melding, creating a third tone in there. It's almost like a supernatural event that happens when those two voices blend. Simon and Garfunkel had a similar chemistry earlier in their career, but on their last two albums, they really started to develop as studio craftsmen, really using the studio as an instrument and creating this whole other aura around the vocal duet. And I think the song that really nails it for me is The Only Living Boy in New York. It's from their last album, their fifth studio album that they did together, Bridge Over Troubled Water. Now, this song was written by Simon to Garfunkel. Garfunkel was already starting to drift away. He was starting to develop a Hollywood movie career. As Simon was writing the songs for this album in New York, Garfunkel was off in Mexico doing a starring role in Catch-22. So Simon was feeling a little bit let down, a little bit lonely, a little bit like, you know, hey, you're out there having fun making movies, and I'm here writing our next record. What's going on? And he puts a little bit in that song. He felt, you know, I'm the loneliest boy in New York. A little self-pity there, right? But they turned it into this magical moment in the studio. Normally, you think of them singing side by side. Here, it's fascinating what they do. They sang together in an echo chamber and then layered those voices 8 or 9 times to create this haunting quality. So when you hear Garfunkel singing Here I Am, it sounds like he's in another country. And metaphorically and literally at the time, he was. He was in Mexico. Mm. Simon's singing about this whole notion of these two friends and collaborators breaking apart. It's almost like a postmodern duet. He's here, but he's not. A beautiful, haunting song, one of the last things Simon and Garfunkel ever recorded together, The Only Living Boy in New York on Sound Opinions.
Tom, get your plane right on time. I know your partner will be fine. Fly down to Mexico.
That's Simon and Garfunkel with The Only Living Boy in New York on Sound Opinions, one of my favorite duets.
And that's a good one, Greg. If we're talking about some of the best duets in musical history, though, we can't leave out the dynamic pairing of Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell.
Absolutely not.
They began collaborating almost by accident. There was a version that Gaye had recorded of Ain't No Mountain High Enough, and there was a version that Terrell had recorded of Ain't No Mountain High Enough, and the powers that be at Motown didn't really think either one was good enough. What happens if we take a little bit from the chocolate side and a little bit from the peanut butter and we put them together? What do we get, right? That is what happened, and they would go on to record a string of fantastic hits. Your Precious Love, Ain't Nothing Like the Real Thing, You're All I Need to Get By, If This World Were Mine. The tune I'm going to play is a little less known. It's the Onion Song. What a strange tune. The world is just a great big onion, and pain and fear are the spices that make you cry. There's also a strange story behind this. Some people say that it is not Tammy Terrell singing with Marvin Gaye. It's the co-songwriter Valerie Simpson. Tammy Terrell would die of a brain tumor. She and Gaye were not together that often on the studio or on stage. She actually collapsed into Gaye's arms on stage and died not long after. But there's a version of events that hold that Simpson, one of the songwriters, sang, and it's her, not Tammy Terrell. Other people say, no, Simpson did a guide vocal, but even though she was in a wheelchair and sick and suffering, it is Tammy Terrell. I'll leave that to the historians to debate, okay? What I'm always interested in a duet is when you have a male singer and a female singer, and they're each telling their story. You get a different version of events. Men are from Mars, women are from Venus, and then the third thing comes together, and it's better than everything. The Onion Song from 1969, I think, is when Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell did it best. Here it is on Sound Opinions.
The world is just a great
Onion Song by Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell on Sound Opinions. Greg, you got another great duet for us?
Jim, I'm glad you brought up Marvin and Tammy because their song, You're All I Need to Get By, actually their version of Nicholas Ashford and Mallory Simpson's song, You're All I Need to Get By, inspired my next pick. It actually has a kind of a checkered history. It began as a track called All I Need on Method Man's solo debut from 1994. Method Man, the first to release a solo record from that Wu-Tang Clan hip-hop posse that revolutionized hip-hop in the early 90s. So All I Need comes out as an album track in 94. In 95, it's remixed as a track called I'll Be There For You, You're All I Need to Get By, and it interpolates that classic Motown standard, You're All I Need to Get By. They added Mary J. Blige to the track as the vocalist, and that's what really makes it. The partnership of Method Man's gruff street tales and Mary J. Blige's commentary on it. Now, the original song was a devotional song. This couple, you know, you're all I need to get by. It was like devotion from man to woman, woman to man. In this particular track, there's a similar kind of sentiment, but it's a little bit more hard-edged. Blige is drifting in and out of the song almost like a ghost, almost like she's numb. She's talking about Method Man, this character, this narrator, and she almost feels like, you know, I'm about to be a widow. You're in this hard life. You're doing everything you can to support the family, but I fear you could be losing your own life because of it. So there's almost a mournful quality to it. Now, there's been several remixes of the song. The RZA version was the huge hit, but there was also a remix by Puff Daddy, of all people, that I really liked, and that's the one I'm going to play. And the reason I like it is that he takes a small sample of a couple of lines from a Notorious B.I.G. song, in which the Notorious B.I.G. says, "Lie together, cry together, I swear to God, I hope we die together." And that adds an added layer of hauntedness to this particular song. He's kind of echoing what Mary J. Blige is saying. So it's this duet with commentary on the side. Really complex, really beautifully done. Method Man and Mary J. Blige from 1995. I'll be there for you. You're all I need to get by on Sound Opinions.
Shorty, you're there for you anytime you need me. For real, girl, it's me in your world. Believe me, nothing make a man feel better than a woman. Queen with a crown, that be down for whatever. There are few things that's forever. My lady, we can make war or make babies. Back when I was nothing, you made a brother feel like he was something. That's why I'm with you to this day, boo, no frontin'. Even when the skies were gray, you would rub me on my back and say, baby, it'll be okay. Now that's real to a brother like me, baby. Never ever give my c*** away and keep it tight, alright? And I'ma walk these doors so we can live in a fat crib with thousands of kids. Work like you don't need a ring to be my wife. Just be there for me and I'ma make sure we be living in the effing lap of luxury. I'm realizing that you didn't have to f*** with me, but you did. Now I'm going all out, kid, and I got mad love to give. You my...
Method Man and Mary J. Blige from 1995, I'll be there for you, you're all I need to get by. A sentence that Greg Kot says to me very often. I'm going to play Led Zeppelin's The Battle of Evermore. It's one of the great Zeppelin tracks. And in the entire Zeppelin catalog, it's the only time when Robert Plant shares vocal duties with someone else. Sandy Denny. Robert Plant is playing the narrator in this creepy tale of supernatural folklore and mythology, and it's a tale of the darkest depths of Mordor. All respect to Peter Jackson, I think the single best piece of art ever inspired by Tolkien. Sandy Denny comes in as the town crier, and she adds an element that really elevates this song above and beyond what it already was. There were a lot of cool songs with, you know, Jimmy Page playing mandolin and Zeppelin in that Zeppelin 3 kind of folky acoustic mode. This is from Zeppelin 4, and every song on that album brought Zeppelin to a new level. This is the song that precedes Stairway to Heaven, of course. I love it to pieces, and everybody loved Sandy Denny's voice, including the people in Zeppelin, who had the hugest egos, but they bowed down to what she had done with Fairport Convention. Tragically, a few years after this release, album came out in 71. In 77, Denny fell more and more into substance abuse, and she fell down the stairs in 78, hit her head very hard, lapsed into coma, and died a short time later. She was one of the great voices out of the UK in the 60s and 70s, and she is always worth remembering. Here is Led Zeppelin with Battle of Evermore on Sound Opinions.
The Queen of Light took her bow, and then she turned to gold. The Prince of Peace embraced the gloom and walked the night alone. Doesn't the dark night seem to her more? The dark lord rides in force tonight, and time will tell us all. Side by side.
Led Zeppelin with Sandy Denny, The Battle of Evermore.
When we return, we'll have more of our favorite duets. That's after a break from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot, and we are sharing some of our favorite duets. Two artists coming together to create something more magical than either of them might have done on their own. We've got a few songs left to share, but Greg, you are up next.
My next choice, Jim, is from the 50s. It's a song by a duo named Mickey and Sylvia. Love is Strange. I love this song, despite its association with Dirty Dancing. Many people who are listening to this show may associate that song. They may have good associations. They may have bad associations. But I will say that Mickey and Sylvia are better actors than Patrick Swayze and Jennifer Grey. No diss on Swayze and Grey, but this song is just a great example of both erotic playfulness and comedy. It has sort of a checkered history, this song, because Bo Diddley apparently wrote it and gave it to the couple because he was having a tiff at the time with Chess Records. Now, they added some stuff to it, clearly. There was an elaborate guitar part that Mickey played on this song, Mickey Baker. He was an accomplished R&B band leader at the time, and his guitar part was borrowed in part from a blues guitar player named Jody Williams, and then he took a little bit of that Bo Diddley Afro-Cuban beat and turned it into this beautifully layered guitar opus. On top of that, you had Sylvia, one Sylvia Robinson. Does that name ring a bell? The future hip-hop mogul for Sugar Hill Records. That Sylvia Robinson.
That Sylvia.
Was the duet partner on this record. There's some subtext to this song as well. Baker, the older man, was apparently much enamored with the younger Sylvia and was constantly trying to court her. She was refusing. So the back and forth in this song is somewhat real. There's a conversation that actually breaks out in the middle of the song that's quite humorous. And when you talk about the duet as being a conversation, that's the absolute height of it. So brilliant musically, extremely funny, a beautiful piece of 50s pop. Love is Strange from Mickey and Sylvia on Sound Opinions.
Love is strange. Lot of people take it for a game. Once you get it, you never want to quit.
My sweet baby,
What a duet. Love is Strange by Mickey and Sylvia. Nice choice. Greg, I know you're going to agree with this one as well. Not only is it one of the great duets of all time, you could say it's one of the great Christmas songs, albeit a very dark one. Fairy Tale of New York by Irish rockers The Pogues, released in 1987 and featuring the female vocals of the British pop singer Kirsty MacColl. This happened by accident. Shane McGowan, leader of The Pogues, was writing this Irish-style folk ballad about a drunk who is thrown into jail in New York. He's an Irish immigrant, and he's either hallucinating or having this inner fight with himself, with his love, who's not there. They're both fairly miserable, lonely, drug-addicted, alcoholic, and it's Christmas. All right, what an uplifting song. It was supposed to be the female vocal part sung by the bassist for The Pogues, but she quit. A lot of people in and out of the Pogues through the years. And they were about to record What's Going to Happen. Steve Lillywhite was producing. He, at that time, was married to Kirsty MacColl. Now, Kirsty MacColl recorded 5 albums. She really became a little bit more popular or much better known in the States. She was always kind of popular in the UK after this song came out. I think her greatest album was Electric Landlady in 1991. She just happened to be in the studio. She did the vocal part. The Pogues liked it so much, they kept it. Tragically, she died in 2000 in a strange boating accident in Mexico. There's a melancholy to this whole song. Of course, you know, Shane McGowan is all about the melancholy. Mm-hmm. A sad life, a great talent. It all comes out in this song. Fairy Tale of New York by The Pogues and Kirsty MacColl on Sound Opinions.
Got on a lucky one. Came in. I've got a feeling this year's for me and you. So happy Christmas. I love you, baby. I can see a better time when all our dreams come true. You promised me Broadway was waiting for me. You were handsome.
You were pretty queen of New York City.
When the band finished playing, they held out for more. Sinatra was swinging, all the drums they were singing. We kissed on the corner, then danced through the night. The boys of the NYPD choir were singing, "Go away, babe." And the bells were ringing out for Christmas Day.
That was Kirsty MacColl with The Pogues, Fairy Tale of New York. Kirsty MacColl also sang some on the Smiths records, Greg.
She's a fine, fine vocalist. You've got a little bit of theme going here. There's sort of a little bit of a mini death trip going on with some of these vocalists in your songs.
This was not intentional. Every one of my female duet partners so far has died.
Sad, but leaving behind some great music, no doubt. My last choice for great duets, Jim, is a track by the Minneapolis group The Jayhawks. The track I'm going to play is from their 1995 album, Tomorrow, the Green Grass, and it is an iconic one for Jayhawks fans. The key to this band has always been the interplay between the voices of Gary Louris and Mark Olson. Louris inevitably taking those high harmonies, Olson down below, the two voices just blending beautifully. You know, this group started playing what later became known as alternative country in the mid-80s. They were using groups like the Louvin Brothers and the Stanley Brothers and the Everly Brothers and the early Byrds with Gram Parsons as benchmarks for how they should sound. Highly unfashionable at the time, but they came up with a sound all their own, and it was really framed around those two voices interacting. The key to those country harmonies that they were referencing was that high, lonesome sound. They love that plaintive melancholy and yet sort of a soaring spiritual quality at the same time. And this song's a sterling example of it. Blue, what a hit it should have been. The voices blending perfectly. And then I love the bridge where there's these counterpoint vocal melodies that Louris and Olson are singing over and under each other. Beautiful song. Still gets me to this day. Still can't figure out why it wasn't a hit. Blue by the Jayhawks on Sound Opinions.
Where have all my friends gone? They've all disappeared.
That is Blue from the Jayhawks on Sound Opinions, one of my favorite duets of all time. Jim, what's your last song?
Well, Greg, throughout I've been saying that I really think a great duet is a conversation back and forth, not just two vocals coming together. And Candy by Iggy Pop is one of those conversations. Iggy said of writing this song, "I was looking back on my relationship with my first girlfriend, Betsy, and I thought, let's be fair. Let's let her have her say." So he's reconsidering his first relationship. Then he brings the girl in. Who's going to play the girl? He turns to someone who I will argue is one of the best all-time go-to I need a duet partner people in the history of rock and roll, Kate Pearson of the B-52s. Kate Pearson has sung with R.E.M. She has sung with the Ramones. She's sung with Matthew Sweet. She's sung with David Byrne and Fatboy Slim. I mean, you talk about diversity. There's something about her voice. Iggy said it best. There is a naive little twang that sounds rural but gorgeous. She comes in and balances Iggy's reminiscences of this first relationship with hers. But both of them find that there's something sweet about this that they are going back to. It's one of Iggy's biggest hits and only major pop hits from 1990. You know, long and storied career and the inventor of punk rock, but this was a big hit for him. Here it is, Candy on Sound Opinions.
Candy, 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 I can't let you go. All my life, you're haunting me, I love you so. Candy, 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 I can't let you go. Life is crazy.
Pop and Kate Pearson of the B-52s with Candy. That wraps up our list of favorite duets, but now we want to hear from you. What is your favorite duet and why? Call and leave us a message at our hotline, 888-859-1800. Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, it's a new year, and we're going to talk about new beginnings, songs that start strong from the very first note.
You can start out strong by finding all our episodes at soundopinions.org and subscribing to the podcast wherever you get such things. Sound Opinions is produced by Brendan Banizak, Alex Claiborne, Ina Contreras, and Andrew Gill.
Listen, baby, ain't no mountain high, ain't no valley low, ain't no river wide.
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So now it's time to hear what you have to say.
New messages.
Hi, Jim and Greg. This is Sarah calling from Chicago. I'm just listening to the episode with the members of Rush, and I'm moved to call you to tell you how much I appreciate you helping me appreciate music and bands that I never would have cared for. I remember an episode years ago on heavy metal that just gave me such an appreciative understanding of that music that I was able to hear it differently. With Rush, I can't say that I enjoy the music anymore, but listening to Geddy Lee and the bass player just made them so much more interesting than they ever were when I was a teenager listening to them. Thanks. Bye.
Wow, you don't get something from nothing, you.
have the world in the palm of your hands, you still might drop it. And everybody wanna reach inside your...
Hi, my name is Brian, and I'm calling from Charlotte, North Carolina, and I wanted to answer the question about the artist we're still mourning at the end of 2018. And the artist that I'm still mourning is Mac Miller. Mac Miller saved my life on countless amounts of times with his words and inspiring attitude, and he was taken from us by an accidental overdose, and you never know what kind of demons people go through. The fact that he was able to put out such amazing music with such quality words and content, and he battled his own demons.
And baby, I've been through it. Enough for the both of us. So come over later, and we won't let no one close to us. We could be posted up. Yeah. Okay, well, you can have the world in the palm of your hands, you still might drop it. And everybody wanna reach inside your pocket, so it goes. It's like in every conversation we the topic.
So we wanna, you know, speak out in his honor. And Mac Miller, we miss you, we love you, and we'll see you again someday.
Well, everybody gather round. I'm still standing, sit down. Whoa, oh.
In love as one they say.
This is Gordon from Tampa Bay, Florida. I'm calling to express my sorrow that we lost the incomparable Miss Nancy Wilson. She had the silkiest, most expressive voice and was able to use it in both jazz, pop, and rock.
The road you leave behind.
She will be sorely missed.
Ahead lies mystery. But oh,
hello, Steve from Chicago, and in memoriam for 2018, the show should give a mention of Hardy Fox, a member of The Resonance, the only member of The Resonance who has revealed himself. He died on October 30th, and the weirdo music community is saddened by his passing. He retired from The Resonance a few years ago due to his ongoing health issues. And he finally succumbed to the great gig in the sky on October 30th. We'll miss him very much. Thanks for everything that you do in music. Talk to you later.
To give us your opinions on Sound Opinions, call our hotline, 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with more Sound Opinions, produced by WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.